As you're sitting down, you're probably having to try and sit around a red envelope that was on your seat. This is kind of an exciting day in the life of our church. Not only is it sort of like the first Christmas that we've ever had together, but to celebrate that, we are taking up what we're calling our Christmas missions offering. This is an offering that we're taking up where 100% of whatever we give together goes out from the ministries of Mercy Church. We're not keeping any of it here. It's going to local ministries here in Charlotte and to church planting efforts around the world. So if you brought your Christmas missions offering with you, as we've been talking about leading up to today, put that in there. And then at the normal time when our offering is taken up, you can just throw this in there just like I'm going to do. This is my family's right here. Now, for all of you that just went, oh man, I thought about that and then didn't think about that. Let me tell you that also opening today on our website through the end of the year, you can give to the Christmas missions offering and designate your gift. Go to mercycharlotte.com/CMO. All right, we good? Good. Okay, so how are you guys doing in preparation for Christmas? Everybody doing okay? Right, isn't it? I know. Like, tomorrow is when I start shopping. I'm pretty excited about it. Like, I'm alone. Come on. That's when I start shopping. And, you know, we think about this. We have a whole month, some of you a lot more, that we gear up for Christmas. Right, we buy all kinds of gifts. We cut down trees and put them in our house. Right, we have the same 20 songs on loop ad nauseum. Like right now, we're about like, all right, it's beginning to look a lot. It's time. Right? Yeah, I get it. I get it. Courtney and I are in this season as a family where we now send out Christmas cards. Oh my goodness, it is kind of like inviting people to your wedding every year. Okay, you go through this, well, should they get a card? I don't know. Well, should they get a card? Well, did they send us a card? Well, if they send the card, maybe we should send them a card. But how much money are we going to spend on cards? And not only that, when is it too late to send a Christmas card and we need to go through rebranding as a New Year's card, right? Yes, this is a conversation that happened last night in my house. So if you haven't received a card, that's why. You know, we're on this quest as my family, probably you in some way or another, to make Christmas kind of perfect, right? Like you want it to be perfect because it's so much build up, and that makes a lot of sense. But you know, when my family growing up to make Christmas perfect, I was the son of an accountant, so perfect equals order. Okay, so in our family, we had an order to every Christmas morning. So you wake up, there's one present that's under the tree that's not wrapped. That's for you to go and look at and admire, whatever. But then you don't do anything else until you go into the dining room where the stockings are now set out at the place you normally eat your breakfast, and you unwrap or do whatever you do to a stocking to get the stuff out of it, right? And then you pause. We have breakfast, which is cinnamon rolls and orange Danish rolls. You can kind of pick what you want there. And then we return back into the living room, and that's where we exchange gifts with one another while Mannheim Steamroller plays. That's the only album allowed to be played. And then there's a fire going on. Sometimes it's an actual fire. More times than not, it's this channel that my parents have that like has a log burning on the TV, and that's the Yule log or whatever. That's what we have going. And every year, my parents want it to be just right and just perfect, and every year it almost is. But it's never actually perfect. It's always something. Right, like it's my mom getting the wrong size shirt for one of us, not that we ever wanted clothes anyways, or it's my brother opening a gift when they got us the same gift, but he opened his first, and my mom's like, oh, and I'm like, I better know what that one is, you know, because it's the same thing. Or it's my dad, it's the face of my mom's face whenever she opens the electronic device that my dad got her, thinking that she never once liked him. And it's like, you'll love this. She's like, I will never use this, you know, ever. Or my mom, she was in charge of all the presents, so she would hide the Christmas presents, you know, so that we wouldn't find them. But then she would forget where she hid them. And sometimes she would forget that she hid them, right? And so about mid-March, this happened many years, my mom would come up and be like, hey, Merry Christmas. We forgot about this, right? That's it. My parents wanted Christmas to be special, to be perfect, and it almost was, but it was never perfect. Or maybe for you, it was like an extended family gathering that where you kind of think of the almost perfect Christmas, but never quite perfect, right? Like maybe it's that cousin that's got all that baggage and they're coming and nobody's talking about what's going on because you're trying to be nice, right? Or maybe it's the aunt. I had this multiple years. My aunt, if you're from the north, she would, my dad's sister, she'd come in always with a different boyfriend that would be like, oh gosh, this loser's not going to be back next year, you know? And why is he asking me for $20? You know, I'm a kid. This is so weird. What's going on here, you know? And we'd have that kind of situation. Everybody has different versions of that, right? We had this great gathering at my grandparents' house where we'd read the story that Pat just read, the Christmas story, and then we'd sit around and say what we're thankful for, and then we'd open up stockings, and my grandfather, still to this day, stuffs stockings for everyone in the extended family. There's like 38 that he's stuffing for this year, you know, even great grandkids get a stocking, and then we do that, and after that, we'd go and we'd play Uno, because my grandmother loves playing Uno. That's the thing that she loved, right? So we'd get around the table, but she was colorblind, so if you know the game Uno, blues and greens, she couldn't tell the difference, which is great for like a 10-year-old, right? I'm like, but she would always go, what color is that? And though she couldn't tell the difference, she could read me like a book, right? So I'd be like, green? She'd, no, it's not. You know, she always read me as an amateur card player. Right? And that was, we'd do that for a couple hours, and then we'd go home. And that was Christmas Eve for my family. And it was almost perfect, at least until, you know, I was about 14 years old, and my grandmother got sick, and she passed away. And some of you guys have had that happen in your life, too. You lost a loved one, and it changes things. It's a hard thing to deal with and carry. But, you know, as hard as that was, you know where it's always still the hardest on my grandfather, and I think on our family as a whole, but definitely on my grandfather? It's at Christmas, right? Because at Christmas, there's a stocking missing, right? And at Christmas, there's a person missing from the card table. You know, Christmas carries this tension with it if we're real about it. Because on the one hand, it is the most wonderful time of the year because we are celebrating the greatest event in human history. And so it is worthy of the pomp and circumstance that we all give it. But on the other hand, it's so important that it creates this heightened sensitivity to all the wrong things that are going on in our world, to the things that just aren't the way that they should be. There are things happening every year at Christmas that just remind us life isn't perfect, right? Maybe it's a problem that you can't seem to solve, like the loss of a loved one. You can't solve that problem. Or maybe it's a job situation that's changed and it's kind of beyond your control. Maybe it's people in your family or near you that are out of control and you can't control them, and that creates all kinds of problems at Christmas. Maybe it's expectations that aren't going to be met. You know, I know some of you, you're going to go home and you're going to get the question, when are you going to move out, right? Or you're going to get the question, when are you going to get a real job? Or when are you going to get married? And if you are married, when are you guys finally going to have kids? When are you, when are you, when are you? It's expectations that you're like, I don't even want to hear this and listen to this. And then if you take enough time to really reflect, to pause this season and kind of reflect on yourself, you kind of start to realize that in some ways, you are the problem you can't solve. You are the person that's out of your control, and you are the one probably setting expectations that other people can't meet, right? I mean, that's, in this season, it's a time where we want everything to be perfect, but if we're honest, everything happening around us is just never really perfect. That's why I believe our passage today, this short little passage, is so helpful to you and I. Because in this passage we're going to read today, our author, Luke, draws our attention away from the things happening around us and towards what has happened for us. See, because our lives are too uncertain to find any kind of hope in our real hope in our present situations. You know, our lives are kind of like shifting sand. You know, it's this way one year, but it could be totally different next year. Maybe, by the way, you're in a year where Christmas is different this year than it ever has been before. And you could use that kind of hope. Today, Luke's going to show us that it will focus our attention not on the things happening around us, but on what has happened for us, on the birth of Christ that has happened for us. We can finally have hope in something that won't let us down, that won't change. They won't come up short and disappoint us. This is hope that can carry us through the rest of our lives, not just through the next few days of Christmas, but something we can ground ourselves in that is certain and unchanging and that has power to give us hope in our lives. That's really our main point for today. If you're kind of like, what's the one thing I want to walk out of here with? It's that we are to hope in what happened for you, not in what is happening to you. That's our main point for today. Hope in what happened for you, not in what is happening to you. And I'm going to give you just kind of where we're going. Today, I want to show you how you can find hope in the birth of Jesus, because that's what we're going to talk about. I'm going to give you my outline. Taipei people, I guess this is like Merry Christmas. I never like give you that right out front, but here we go. I want you to see two things. I want you to see you can have hope in the fact of Christmas, and you can have hope in the pattern of Christmas. And that's two things we're going to look at in these seven verses. So we're going to jump in. This is Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. Here we go. Are you ready? Great. Didn't give you time because only like seven of you would say it, and the rest of you would kind of nod your head, and then it'd be awkward, and I'd say, are you really ready? So here we go. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was the governor of Syria. I want to stop right there in this seemingly background information and talk about the fact of Christmas. I want to get real for a second. This passage that we're reading is incredibly familiar to most of you, right? A recent study that I heard, I think I might have shared this with you guys, just said that it was done in Charlotte on millennials in Charlotte, which is the 18 to 35-year-old age range. It said among millennials in Charlotte, 90% of them have been to a church gathering. 20% consider themselves Christian. All right, so that's what we had there. 90% have been to church in some fashion. 20% call themselves Christian. It speaks to a trend on the general population of our town here. People are familiar with Christianity. They just don't buy it. And the numbers when you go beyond the millennial generation are pretty similar. You might have a little bit more who would say they call themselves Christian, but it's pretty similar. And all the stories in the Bible, this one's probably the top two most widely known. There's a really good chance that you, even if you hadn't been in a church in a long while, you wander back in here this weekend, there's a good chance that you've heard this one. It means many people are familiar with this story, but they hear it and they think, what a lovely legend. Oh, what a lovely legend. It is. It's lovely. It teaches us how to live and how to find hope in the most unlikely of places. It's a feel-good story that makes for a nice Christmas experience. You sing O Holy Night, you light a candle, and you kind of snuggle up with Jesus for Christmas, right? The problem is, Luke isn't writing a feel-good story. Luke's writing a historical account of something that really happened. This is why he says, remember the year when Quirinius became governor of Syria? Remember that year? It was that same year when Caesar Augustus, he ordered for that big census to happen that year. That's the year when all of this happened. You don't say that if you're writing a legend or a fairy tale, right? Luke doesn't start this whole thing with, you know, once upon a time, or maybe more frequent, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, right? That's not how he starts this. That's reference number one. We'll see how many come. That's not how he starts this thing, right? No, he's saying this happened. This event happened on a real day, in a real city, in a real area, when these other real events were going on. In fact, he does the same thing at the beginning of chapter 1 as well. And the way Luke opens his gospel, he says, you know, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, kind of like a reporter, what he's doing here. It's like, I've been watching things happen. I've been hearing everything, been looking at it. It seemed good to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. This is Luke's audience, this guy that most people think was probably just kind of a well-off Roman that Luke's writing this to. And he's saying, I'm writing this so that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. See, Luke's a physician, right? So Luke's writing like a physician. He's got a physician's mind, and he's really most concerned with facts. What actually happened? That's what he wants to make clear. And in the beginning of chapter 1 and then the start of chapter 2, he wants you to know the baby born in the manger is Jesus. He is the Son of God. He's being born in the form of a human, and it all really happened. That's what he's going after. So here's a question. Why does it matter that this is a fact and not a legend? I want to tell you that it matters that this is real because life is real. All right, I don't believe most of you are here today to play the church game. Maybe some of you are, but many of you aren't here to go through the motions and just deal in sentimentalities. We're kind of done with that. I've got better things to do than play that game. Life is real. And it's not going to be a perfect Christmas. And for you, maybe 2016 is looking uncertain too. And if all I offer you is some warm and snuggly experience, that's going to last all the way to your car. And maybe not even that far since it's finally cold outside, right? And then it's back to dealing with real life, where there are real problems. And you need more than a little inspiration to deal with those real problems. You remember last week I read you Isaiah 9:6. It's a verse that you see a lot around Christmas time. It says, "For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." And this is the verse we love to put on Christmas cards, right? It's like a field covered in snow, you know, with like soft lighting, and there's a small house in the back with one candle lit, and it says in cursive, "For unto us a child is born." Maybe this is because I'm a pastor. I always get 3 or 4 of those cards. It's like my family doesn't know what to send me now. Like, well, I better get the spiritual card, right? I never send that to them, but they always send it to me, right? And that's the verse that is almost always on there. For unto, because they don't want to do the Luke one. They want to be like, oh, I really thought about this. I'll send the Isaiah one. So everybody sends the Isaiah one, right? It's a nice sentiment, but it is sorely misunderstood. See, most of the time, we see this thing kind of like a Christmas sweater. But this thing is a bulletproof vest. In Isaiah 8:22, God says, "They will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness." And that might sound like some of your Christmases. There's now some darkness that you are personally trying to walk through. I mean, I'll be kind of transparent with you guys. A few years ago, Courtney and I lost a child, a miscarriage. And that was really hard. And we carry that with us. The other day, just kind of, you know, we've told our boys this because it was, you know, we already had 2 children and so they kind of were there when this happened. We told our boys about it. And the other day, Zeke looks at me, he says, "Dad, you know, Christmas would be perfect." He said, "Tonight would be perfect. We're all sitting around the dining room table. If there was one more person." I was like, "What are you talking about, bud?" He said, "You know, the baby that you guys lost, if that baby was here, then our family would be complete." And he's 7. And I'm like, "Man, you know, bud, you're right. It would be, and that baby's not here, and that's sad. And we miss that child, for sure. You know, that's something that, Courtney and I, there's a stocking that's not on our mantle that should be. And we carry that with us. And that is hard. That is some darkness that we kind of walk with. And we're like, how do we deal with that? You know, sentimental, nice sayings cannot help us with that, right? I mean, I love Christmas cards. There's no Christmas card that can carry that kind of weight. And some of you are dealing with, maybe it's loss again, but maybe it's something else. And there's no just like one of the routines of Christmas cannot deal with the weight of what you're dealing with, right? I mean, doesn't matter. Isaiah 8 leaves a gloomy picture of the darkness of the life of God's people we're walking in. But then comes Isaiah 9, like a boss. In the midst of death, the midst of pain, the midst of cynicism, Isaiah 9:2. The people walking in deep darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of darkness, a light has dawned. The people walking in darkness, see those words, deep darkness? I bet you think he means spiritual darkness. I bet you think this is the same old sentimental Christmas stuff. That's not what he's talking about here. This word literally translates, deep darkness, translates the death shadow, which is both an extraordinary Bible verse and an incredible Star Wars character, right? You know what this death shadow is caused by? It was caused by all the stuff God's people saw when they looked out on the earth. The death, the war, the emotional anguish. You know, it's the murder, the drama, the divorce, the stuff that typically causes us to lose a little bit of hope at Christmas. You felt the death shadow when you saw what unfolded over at San Bernardino. You felt the death shadow when you saw what happened in 9/11. But it's not just in big tragic events. We're living in the shadow of death every day. Every day we see that everything around us in some way or another is decaying. I need look no further than my own body, okay? At 20 years old, I could do a really long workout. I could be recovered in under 3 minutes. I could go eat a burger and a milkshake and fries and somehow improve my physique, okay? Now, I look at anything chocolate with like this mental risk assessment management calculator going on. Like, is this gonna be worth it? You know, my joints creak, right? I'm slowly decaying, and so are you. Merry Christmas. Right? And it's always been this way. The shadow of death has always been with us. There's no technological advancement that can cure it, no magic bullet. No matter how many people tell me that death is just natural, it's just a part of life, they hate when it happens to someone close to them. If we're honest, we hate that we all live in a world where we can't avoid the death shadow, where it always comes too soon and it corrupts the good things in our lives. And here's the scariest thing of all. We know that this darkness isn't just something that corrupts the things outside of us. It corrupts our own hearts too. The darkness of the human heart is the source of the whole spectrum of evil, from terrorism headlines to your struggling marriage. This is why we can't settle for a sentimental Christmas. This is why Jesus can't just be a good teacher or a moralistic fable that teaches us about humility and how to be nicer to each other. He's got to be a hero, a warrior, a mighty God, a prince of peace. Because y'all, one of my children is gone. And one day I'll be gone too, and so will you. Which means we don't need legends about the glory of God. We need the glory of God to intervene and deal with this thing that we cannot solve on our own. So Jesus better actually be doing something about the death shadow, or else we're just singing Christmas carols until one day the sun burns out. Of course, Jesus is that light shining into that darkness. The child in Isaiah 9:6 is the light from Isaiah 9:2 that's going to war against the shadow of death. And that light dawns on us when God became flesh. And through the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, we become the children of God. The mighty hero rescued us out of the shadow of death and adopted us into his kingdom, the one of the beloved Son. This is why John, another one of our gospel writers, he opens his gospel saying this. He says, in him was life. And the life, that life was the light of all mankind. And the light shines in the darkness. And listen, the darkness has not overcome it. That is powerful hope for you and I this Christmas. Do you hear the hope there? Jesus has burst into the darkness and trampled the death shadow. Instead of darkness swallowing you up, the light has swallowed the darkness. And Luke is saying that victory is a fact that you can hope in. Your darkness cannot overcome Jesus, no matter what it is. Jesus wins now, he wins forever. He can and will beat the darkness in your life. That is the fact of Christmas. I know some of you, you want to go deeper into the historical reliability of the New Testament, of the birth of Jesus, and I can't get into that right here. I want to give you a recommendation for you to jot down and go look up. There's a guy named Richard Baucom wrote an awesome book called Jesus, A Very Short Introduction. And I promise, it is short, and it is an introduction. And it goes through the reliability of the accounts of Jesus' birth. And that's there, and it's good for you to investigate that, and that's a good one for you to look at. It'd be a great stocking stuffer for nerds like me that you know. This will be a great one, okay? Back into Luke 1. All right, we're going to move over to verse 3. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. Verse 4, and Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. Just kind of a note here. See Joseph with Mary? Joseph was the guy that was going to divorce this girl, right? Now, he's walking into the hometown of his ancestors with his pregnant fiancée. Amazing how God will kind of reroute your life, right? Here's what I love. Joseph believed what this angel came and said to him. He said, look, don't be afraid of marrying Mary, okay? She's going to have a child, and this child will save his people from their sins. By the way, call him Jesus. So Joseph marries her, but then he doesn't sleep with her until after Jesus is born. You get this? Joseph obeyed God, did what he was told to do, and the result of his obedience was wandering into Bethlehem with a new wife he wasn't sleeping with, who was pregnant, and they're about to be spending several nights out on the streets or in a stable. Really, God? This is my reward for obeying you, doing what you've called me to do? There's no way Joseph could understand all that God was doing, but he followed God into the unknown anyway. And some of you, God is calling to step out in obedience to him in some way or another. And you're wondering what will happen when you take that step of faith into the unknown. Whether it means getting out of a relationship that's not honoring God, or maybe it means coming clean about some things, or maybe it means obeying a call to literally redirect your life and go to the nations. You might find yourself sleeping in a hut in the Middle East in 2 years wondering, really? This, God, this is what I get for obeying you? I said yes, and this? There's a bigger story God is writing. And if you'll lose yourself in it, you'll find being a part of his story is so much greater and more fulfilling than just writing your own. It's just an aside I see there. Verse 6, and while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. See, in the birth scene, we see the pattern of Christmas. I want you to get this setting because it will reveal so much about the gospel Luke is unfolding for us. First, look at the location, the manger. You know, book publishers and really all of us, we tend to romanticize this scene. Again, you've driven around, you've seen the nativity scenes, although I have seen some, there's one guy who thought he saw a nativity scene, and the guy who's writing was like, nah, bro, that's Luke and Leia that somebody had like put out in their front yard. But for the most part, you're seeing nativity scenes. You know, and you know the ones with the half-smiling cows and the animals all behaving, and there's Joseph and he's got his arm wrapped around Mary and they're looking at the baby, right? And everything's kind of a soft lighting again going around, you know? We have a nativity set at our house a few weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago, my 2-year-old kidnapped baby Jesus. He is yet to be recovered. We trust that we will still be able to share the Christmas story without, she don't know where it is, so you can pray for her soul. But it's kind of, we start to think about it, it's a little bit off, and maybe wrong, for us to trivialize the birth of Jesus like this. Because the reality is, the birth of Christ was brutal. First, they're homeless. They're not in a hotel. They're not in a hospital. They can't afford a room. And even though this is the town of his ancestors where you'd think he'd have a connection, Joseph has nothing. They are so rejected that a woman who is 9 months pregnant cannot get a room. And it's not like she had the baby the day they rode in. It was a few days, if not much longer, living on the streets or in a stable. The absurdity of this is incredible to me. I mean, who rejects a woman who is 9 months pregnant? That's the rejection they faced. And so there she is in labor. Ladies, in labor. Labor is not pretty anyways. I know it's a miracle, but not all of God's miracles are pretty, okay? I've been around for some of those. Having a baby in a stable with nasty, disease-ridden animals, only Joseph to help, no team of doctors and nurses, no epidural, no help, no nothing. She has that baby, and it's just her and Joseph. She's even the one that has to wrap the baby up. No nurse to do that for her. Everything Luke is telling us is creating a picture that Jesus was being born into a poor, obscure, rejected family. In the beginning of his life, Jesus is rejected by the world. And this is Luke's foresight into the gospel that he's about to announce to us. He's telling us the meaning of Christmas. If Jesus was coming to defeat the shadow of death, why come as a rejected, helpless baby? Why not come as a conquering king? Because listen, Jesus didn't come to be accepted. He came to be rejected. He didn't come to bring judgment. He came to bear the judgment, our judgment. Why? So that he could destroy the shadow of death without destroying us who were marred by it. This is where Christianity diverges from every other religion I know. I read an article on CNN this week, a guy named Jeffrey Weiss, who was writing an article called Do Christians, Muslims, and Jews Worship the Same God? Right? And right here in this stable is the definitive difference in Christianity from everything else All other major world religions have a system for earning God's approval. It kind of makes sense on the surface. You know, the more pious you are, the more you obey what your God tells you to do, the more favorable your standing with God is. If you really work for it, you can earn God's favor. What makes Christianity so scandalous is that it looks at that system and says, no, your heart is too dark. You cannot overcome the evil within you. And even if you could, you can't stop the darkness around you. So Jesus says, you can't save yourselves, so I am coming to save you. He's come to take the punishment for your sin and mine, which means the incarnation, the birth of the God-man, and the resurrection when Christ got up out of the grave, and the other miracles that he does. They're not stories to teach us how to live. They're salvation for us. Look at the pattern of Christmas, the parallels between his birth and his death. Here he's put into a wooden trough, later nailed to a wooden cross. Here he's rejected by an innkeeper. Later, the whole population would yell, crucify him. Here he's wrapped in old cloths. Later, he's even stripped naked and killed. Here he's rejected by the people around him. Later, rejected even by God the Father. Why? Well, Isaiah, to go back to him, Isaiah 53. Guess, maybe you've heard this before. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. As one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. Jesus was rejected so that we could be accepted by God. There was no room for him in the inn so that you and I can dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So what do you do with this? How does this affect you this Christmas? It goes back to what we started with. You find hope in what happened for you, not what's happening to you. This is where real hope is. First, it means you have a light at the end of the tunnel. Christ has killed the shadow of death. If you will give your life to him, you can have hope that God is going to set all things right in the end. The hope of heaven, yo, that's a powerful hope. This fact creates a hope that you can rest securely in. That one day, you who are in Christ will spend eternity with God, the Father in heaven. You can be secured in that hope. And no matter how dark the tunnel right now, the light will never go out. Amen. And one day that light will overcome that darkness. And that gives you a true north to navigate by. What about now, you ask? Well, first of all, I just gave you the hope of heaven, so it's kind of greedy to ask for more. But okay, here's a couple of things right here and now. First, in the here and now, darkness will not overcome you. Some of you are carrying burdens that have you on the brink of tears. I know. And as your pastor, I need you to hear something. Go back to it. God has promised the darkness, that the death shadow will not overcome Christ. And he said that if you are a Christian, your life, Colossians 3, is literally hidden within him. All right? Which means you can grieve, you can hurt, and you can still not be overcome by that grief or by that pain. And Christ can bring healing to you in the here and now. And you can finally find rest and peace that your soul is longing for. But you'll have to give your whole life to him for it. You know, I told you about Courtney and I's story when we lost a child. 1 Thessalonians 4 became our anthem. So, you know, it says, grieve when someone goes to sleep. You can grieve, but you can grieve as those with hope. Do not grieve as those with no hope. Why? Because Jesus died and then he rose again. And one day we will meet those who have gone before us. That's the hope of the gospel. That's real with what you're dealing with. Another thing, this means you can have hope in the face of rejection. Actually, you should expect to be rejected in some way or another if you're a Christian. I've already seen it multiple times since we started our church here in Charlotte. There are people rejected and or passed over in their workplace because they actually work with integrity. Listen, people hate integrity. Now, they'll act like they like it and they'll talk about liking it, but integrity, when it slows progress or threatens the bottom line, they hate it. And you'll get rejected for it. People even hate integrity in relationships. They want you to compromise your character to satisfy the desires of their flesh. And if you don't, they'll probably reject you. So the question, are you walking in integrity in the character of Christ? If so, expect to be rejected. Don't be surprised by this. And when you are, you can have hope that you are walking in the path of Christ and that your life is hidden with him and secured with him. And you can have hope in that security. I want to put Isaiah 9:2 back up for you. The people walking in deep darkness have seen a great light. And on those living in the land of darkness, a light has dawned. Here's what we're going to do. Our worship team, they're going to come back up. We got another team that's getting set up, and they're going to actually lead us in communion. And we're going to take communion together. Because I can think really of no better way to reflect on this light that has dawned in the midst of the darkness that you are dealing with than to celebrate the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. And he gave the church a means to do that. So as our teams come, they're going to start coming and passing this. Listen, if you're new to church or anything, just let this pass by you. Communion, what it is a symbol of the gospel. It's not the gospel itself. There's nothing that will save you by taking these elements. You're going to get passed a piece of bread and a cup. And when Christ was with his disciples, he looked at them and he said, guys, this represents my salvation for you. And that was all started back at the birth of Christ. Now, the whole thing, this salvation that is afforded you, this light to overcome the darkness that you're dealing with, that all started right here in the birth of Christ. So I want you to take a second. You hold on to that elements. We're going to take those together. Here's what I want you to do. While you're taking that, while our teams are passing it, worship team's going to kind of play and give you a chance just to reflect. I want you to reflect on, man, what is the darkness? What's the happenings that are happening around you right now? I want you to take some time to just acknowledge those. Maybe it's pain, maybe it's suffering, maybe it's rejection, maybe it's uncertainty, whatever it is. I want you to just kind of bow your head, close your eyes, and talk to God about it. Tell him, God, this is what I'm dealing with. And I want you to ask him to give you hope in the gospel, in what has happened for you, instead of you being overwhelmed by your present circumstances.